101.3.
And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you this afternoon, along with co-host Bonnie Berman. This hour, we begin with Brown University economics professor Dr. Mark Blythe. He's the author of Austerity, the History of a Dangerous Idea. He contends that worldwide government spending cutbacks actually make economies worse. We'll learn more about his theory this hour. Mark Blythe joins us from Boston. Welcome to you, Professor.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. So it seems counterintuitive. Isn't austerity the common sense answer to overspending and huge debt?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's precisely why it's wrong. It was common sense for a long time that the Earth was flat. Turned out it wasn't. So why is the common sense actually not the best way of thinking about it? It's really kind of simple. If at the end of the day you need income from which to save, if everyone is cutting at the same time, and this is the problem you got in Europe, where you have all these economies trying to do this at the one time, if everyone cuts at the one time, no one's generating income. So the only thing you can save from is your assets, your capital stock, your reserves. So you shrink the economy, and as you shrink the economy, the same amount of debt gets bigger rather than smaller. So there's a paradox at work in the heart of it. So if you're an economy and you're doing, let's say, what the American economy did in 1994, when you paid back quite a lot of debt, we did it from a position of growth, because when you're growing and the economy is growing, tax receipts are going up. So you've actually got more money with which you can choose to pay back debt. That's sensible fiscal consolidation. There's nothing wrong with that at all. But if you do this, as they're doing in Europe and some people would like to do in the United States, when you're in recession, you're doing it when your tax receipts are going down, your transfers because of unemployment and other things are going up, your deficit's getting bigger, not smaller, and you're trying to pay back debt. If you do this at the same time when everybody else is doing it, as they're doing in Europe, it simply makes the problem worse and the debt bigger rather than smaller.
In the U.S., haven't we been living beyond our means with so many programs, wars, and government waste?
Well, let's parse that out a little bit. I would say that basically two wars of dubious utility that weren't financed by taxes, that's definitely one. But we could take any program and you'll have its defenders and you'll have its detractors. But let's think about it this way. Collectively, we pay less tax now on the income tax level than we did under Reagan, and certainly under Nixon. Back in the day, at the height of American power, when it was 60% of world GDP and 50% of global finance, under Eisenhower, the top rate of marginal taxation was 91%, 87% with tax relief. We're not even close to that now. So with all the stuff that we want, and people want different things, we end up spending at the federal level 25% of GDP, which is very low in comparison to most advanced countries, actually. But here's the trick. We only tax at 18%. So that gap is your deficit. Multiply that over several years, and you don't need wars or anything else to get you into trouble. Basically, we're fiscal teenagers. We don't want anything cut unless it belongs to someone else, and the problem is not many programs exist like that. And basically, we don't raise enough taxes to pay for what we've got.
So you're concluding that the time for austerity is during a boom and not a slump.
That's exactly right. That's sensible fiscal consolidation. And, you know, people make these analogies to families and all the rest of it. And there's good ways of doing it, some bad ways of doing it. You know, a good way of doing it is the following. If you get a new job and if you increase your income into the family, it's probably a good idea to retire that credit card. If you're made unemployed, trying to pay back the credit card debt at the same time is probably going to mean that you're not going to be able to pay the mortgage. So those analogies that we like to say, oh, we need to all tighten our belts, it's just like the family, if the problem's too much debt, then stop spending. You don't even have to go to that, well, what happens if everyone does it at once? Simply on its own terms, it simply makes sense to do this when you're growing, not when you're in a slump. When you're in a slump, you should do the exact opposite.
How did austerity historically affect the Great Depression?
Well, that's the last time that you had all the major economies in the world basically in recession at the same time and all trying to cut. And the problem with doing so is it becomes zero sum against everybody else. So if you go back to the 1930s, you have a situation where you've got the United States, the United Kingdom, Germany, France, and Japan, and they all try to cut at the one time. This leads to very, very bad consequences. For example, the story we often hear is that the great inflation of 1923 brought Hitler to power. But hang on a minute, Hitler didn't come to power until 1931. And between 24 and 28, Germany was one of the more stable economies in Europe. What actually happened was a lot of short-term money that was coming from America dried up in 1928. The Germans decided austerity was the way forward. They cut, 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 and the more that they cut, the more the unemployment rate up. And the one party that gained the votes was the Nazi Party, because they were the ones who stood against austerity. In Japan, it was even worse. There you had a very weak democracy and a very large military that was bearing the brunt of the cuts. After 10 years of cutting their way to prosperity, the military decided to assassinate two prime ministers, two finance ministers, and a bunch of bankers who were in charge of the major banks. Austerity on its own can rack up quite a body count. So the problem here is, if your income is somebody else's exports, and your exports is somebody else's spending, and everybody tries to retrench all at once, you all just get poorer, and the amount of debt you have gets bigger rather than smaller. Britain tried to cut its way to growth all the way through the 1930s. In 1931, it had about 150% debt to GDP. By 1933, it was 171%, and not because they were spending more, but because the underlying economy was getting smaller and smaller because of cuts.
We're speaking with Professor Mark Blythe of Brown University. He's an economics professor. We're talking about his book, Austerity, the History of a Dangerous Idea. If you'd like to join in with a comment or a question, you're certainly welcome. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email.
Email is radio@WLRN.org. radio@WLRN.org. You can also tweet us, and that's at Topical Currents. Professor, you say that austerity destroys the social fabric. Can you explain how that works?
Yeah, sure. Think about it this way. So we spend a lot of money on public schools here in the United States, and for the past 30 years, everyone's been complaining about how terrible they are. Well, you could say it's teachers' unions, but here's the weird thing. There are countries around the world with vastly superior economic outcomes and educational outcomes that have much higher unionization rates amongst their teachers. And we certainly spend a lot of money on it, so that's kind of weird. So what would it be? Well, what else has been going on over the past 30 years? You've had this rise of high finance and this huge growth of the financial sector, and we notice that a lot of the incomes associated with that are very, very high, and that they've gone to a very small percentage of the population, who now effectively insure themselves by sending their kids to private school. So what happens if all the people with the money, the talent, the political connections, and the drive exit the system and self-insure by sending their kids to elite private schools? Obviously, everyone left in the system is going to have less of that stuff going around their schools, and that means that their average on all, the overall average is going to drop. And that's precisely what's happened. So when you have very, very high levels of inequality, when you have very asymmetric rewards going to one part of society, and then when that blows up in a financial crisis, do we actually allow those people who have taken those risks to bear those risks? No, we bail them out. And then when we bail them out, what we're effectively doing is bailing out the assets and the income of the small part of the population that has most of the assets and most of the income. And then they turn around and say, oh, look at that debt. Well, that debt is a consequence of the bailouts. Let's not make any mistake about this. In 2006, no one was jumping up and down talking about the shocking federal debt from either party. It came from the bailouts. And once we'd bailed them out, what happens? You have to then push it down the income distribution to everyone else who relies on government services. And that's the bit that gets cut. Meanwhile, Goldman Sachs is back to making record profits, but anybody who's working in a teacher in a school in Florida might be losing their job. That's why this is tearing at the social fabric. This is why this is about politics, not about some kind of normal set of economic principles.
Do you think the banks should have been allowed to fail?
I actually do, and I actually began thinking that they shouldn't. I really bought the line that there's all these systemic interconnections with so-called derivatives, and the whole system's too big to fail, and so on and so forth. And I find myself now looking at the example of Europe and saying, well, they've been doing austerity for the past 4 years. They have 26 million extra unemployed. They've lost 30% or 20% of GDP in the periphery, depending on what country you're looking at. They have above 50% youth unemployment. How bad would it have been if they'd let their banks fail? Because they didn't. They're still in the midst of cleaning up their mess. And the cost of us cleaning up our mess is this debt, which actually is now coming down. And why is it coming down? And very rapidly, because we didn't cut. That's why the American economy is growing and the European economy is falling off a cliff.
So was the chief culprit really overlending and then the subsequent defaults?
It's not the chief culprit. We have to think about this responsibility on both sides. And this is true here on the story of mortgages in the United States. And it's true in the Eurozone and the Germans versus the Greeks and so on. You cannot have overborrowing unless you have overlending. Now, let me remind you of something or ask you a question about something, if I may. The first ever billion-dollar advertising campaign for a bank was Citibank between 2003 and 2006. They had one slogan that was their chief slogan for that campaign. Can either of you remember what that was?
No.
Let me tell you what it was. Live richly.
Oh, yeah.
Not be rich. Not go out and buy yourself something nice if you've saved up your money. Live richly. They used to have a slogan. It was called Open a Cravings Account. Now, this is basically a credit pump. So you're pushing things on credit. The people who are banking the loans are then securitizing them, selling them off to a bigger fool, so they never have to bear the costs. And it doesn't matter who you're bringing in on the bottom end to buy the loans, so long as you're selling the loans. So there's huge amount of culpability on the buy side as well as there is on the sell side. And we have to look at this systemically as a whole picture rather than trying to find one aspect and blame that for the crisis.
We're speaking with Mark Blythe. He's a professor of international political economy at Brown University and director of Brown's Programs in Development Studies and International Relations. He's the author of Austerity, the History of a Dangerous Idea. On today's Topical Currents, we're going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
This is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. 91 degrees currently in Miami under mostly cloudy skies. If you are 55 or older, you could be at risk for age-related macular degeneration, the leading cause of blindness in older Americans. The Foundation Fighting Blindness and the AMD Alliance are working together to provide answers for those affected and for those at risk. Info at fightblindness.org. That's a notice from the WLRN Community Bulletin Board.
PRI's The World brings you more than news.
You have your own honey.
Each day we test your knowledge of places and people with the world's geoquiz.
This is one of the crocodiles we had to...
We provide clues.
I think it has a bit of an onion smell.
You guess the mystery location. Play along by texting in your answer. Text the word geoquiz to 69866. Message and data rates may apply. You'll hear the answer on the next edition of The World.
Coming up today at 3 p.m.
And it's our Monday edition.
Pushing things.
Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation. Excuse me. With Brown University Professor Mark Blythe. If you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email radio at WLRN.org or Twitter at Topical Currents. Juan in Tamarack. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question in regards to austerity. I believe our guest is saying that austerity is always the wrong approach for a country to resolve a debt problem. Are there any examples at all historically where spending has been the problem and the approach of resolving it through spending has also created an issue, or is that always a working solution? And I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's a great question. So let me jump right in there. Of course you can spend money on nonsense. And what the argument I make in the book is that spending should be counter-cyclical, only counter-cyclical. And that means the following. If you find the recession's very, very deep and you decide that you want to intervene because you think that essentially you're going to have an accelerating depression, then do so. But what that means is when the economy recovers, you don't give yourself another round of tax cuts. You actually pay back the debt you've accumulated, and you tax at the level that you spend. And if you're not willing to tax at the level you spend, you should spend less. But that's not austerity. Austerity is when you decide to cut in a recession on the presumption that this is the correct policy to reduce debt and increase growth. And that is what I object to, and I try and show in the book, never, ever works. There is nothing wrong with paying back your debts when you can do it from a position of strength. Trying to do it from a position of weakness, particularly when all your trading partners are doing the same thing, is what gives Europe the problem that it's in just now. So can spending be the wrong approach? Absolutely. You can overspend just as you can also cut too much. But it depends on the context. My bottom line on the following is you don't really need to spend. Just stop cutting. That would be a good idea.
Explain this fallacy of composition.
Sure, it's an ugly term, but I can't come up with anything better, and that's what people generally call it. So what's individually rational is collectively disastrous. So let me go back to that example of schools, right? So you find this all the time in metropolitan areas. I'm sure Miami is just the same thing. So you have middle-class people who are saying, well, I'd really like to send my kid to the public school, but, well, I don't know, it's just not that great, whatever. So, you know, it's going to cost us like 30% of our disposable income to send them to a private school, but we're going to do it anyway. Now, this is a waste of resources for the family. It's probably based on paranoia and misjudgment. But nonetheless, they do that. Now, what happens if everybody individually, rationally, who can do that, does that? You end up residualizing the average income in the school, and you end up creaming off the people that could contribute more to the school. So what's individually rational becomes collectively disastrous. That is the key insight of the arguments against austerity. It makes perfect sense for any one country or one firm or even one family to cut their budgets. But if they all cut it simultaneously, what's individually rational becomes collectively suicidal. And Europe is proving this every moment.
Professor, let's be realistic politically. In the U.S., if a candidate talks against austerity, he or she is labeled a big spender, and they really don't have a chance of being elected.
Yep, that's a tragedy. And I would love to see one thing, a bipartisan consensus that said the following. I'll agree to spend when we're in recession if you agree to cut when we're having a boom. And the problem is nobody wants to cut from either party when they're in the boom. And one party says we should just cut as a matter of course, regardless of the circumstances. And that's the real political problem we have. The way I like to think of it is back in 2006, when U.S. debt to GDP was 61%, no one was jumping up and down in the Senate saying, hey, let's pay back some debt. Everyone, if anyone was saying anything, was saying, let's deregulate more and let's have another round of tax cuts. So what we have is endemic fiscal irresponsibility in both of our parties, precisely because there's no electoral upside to telling the truth about budgets.
How does deficit spending figure into your theory?
Deficit spending is a means, not an end. You know, my economics are mainly Hippocratic. That is to say, Hippocrates, first do no harm. And cutting when you're in a recession is the definition of harm. I believe that the economy has powerful self-healing tendencies. Left on its own devices, 9 times out of 10, it will be fine. But 1 time out of 10, you need an insurance policy, and deficit spending is an insurance policy. Think about it this way. Imagine you've got the private sector and the public sector, and the public sector is sitting there on its standard sort of debt load. And then the private sector has a big shock for whatever reason, the financial crisis, etc. Lots of people start paying back their debt in advance, incomes start to drop, unemployment starts to rise. Well, if the public sector doesn't run a deficit at that point, you're going to accelerate the deleveraging of the private sector. Now, some people would say, that's good, binge and purge, get it out of the system. The problem is when you do this, you cannibalize your own capital stock, you reduce your productivity, you destroy the skills that you've got, and it's actually harder and takes you longer to come back. And again, that's what Europe is proving just now.
I suppose you're not a Grover Norquist fan.
Well, anyone at all, no, it's not Grover Norquist, anyone at all who has one fixed maxim, and that's how you run life regardless of any and all evidence, I regard this someone I would hold with a bit of suspicion.
So tell us what your solutions are. You mentioned you call it the Hippocratic economics.
Mm-hmm.
Start there and tell us what you would have done, what you would do now.
Sure. So Hippocratic economics, first do no harm. Don't do things that you know will hurt. I mean, it's what you tell your two-year-old, so that's a pretty good place to start. And we have a natural experiment running across the world just now. So the United States, because of gridlock, and this is the positive side of gridlock, means that we haven't been able to cut as much as the Republicans would like. And because of that, the cuts that we have got, which are harmful through the sequester, are not nearly as bad as they could be. Because of that, what should be a 3.5% recovery is now a 2.5% recovery. We could be doing better, but we're still growing. Why? Because we haven't been able to cut. Now, look at the Brits. The Brits are sitting there. They have their own central bank, their own currency, the whole lot. They have all the same structural advantages in the United States, but they decided to cut. Their economy hasn't grown a jot in 5 years. Their unemployment rate's higher, and they're running a 6% deficit. Ours is going to be 3% next year. Now look at Europe. Europe has decided to cut, regardless of any and all evidence to the contrary. And as I've mentioned, 50% unemployment, 20% GDP drop, a terrible, terrible situation because they have done this. So this is a natural experiment. It's a real-time proof of this. So here's the first one. Just stop doing it. Because if the American example shows you anything, simply not doing austerity allows you to get out of the recession. And as the economy recovers and tax receipts go up, you can pay back more of your debt. We're online to have 70% debt to GDP. Practically everyone in Europe's close to 100. Their debts have been going up the more they've cut. Ours is going down precisely because we haven't. Therefore, just keep doing what we're doing. In fact, get rid of the idiotic sequester, but then let's have a bipartisan agreement that it's good to spend when the economy is going down, particularly serious recessions. Not every single bump in the road should be compensated. That was the problem with the Greenspan era. But when there's a serious recession, then you deal with it. But then when you recover, that money you've made, those tax receipts, they go back to debt reduction. And if we had that, a sensible counter-cyclical policy, we wouldn't have half the mess that we were in.
Do I hear a little Scott in your accent, Professor?
More than a little. More than a little. I actually, after 23 years in the United States, I actually have the same accent as Shrek, which is kind of weird. I'll prove this. Look, donkey. There you go.
Let's take another caller. This is John in Fort Lauderdale. Hi.
Professor, I have a question. I'll try to my best to explain this to you. Don't you agree that they're dividing the globe up in unions? And what they found that the actually elite do not want to deal with all these debts that are in different countries when they absorb all these areas and divide them for resource purposes so they can all trade amongst each other. And they're fighting right now on the ideas of the most elite minds that are trying to push this on the globe, I guess. What's your opinion on that?
I'd say, John, that you're definitely onto something there in the following sense. We've had an unprecedented accumulation of income and wealth in very few hands. Literally, the old golden era where you would walk around the mansions in Newport, Rhode Island, we've actually surpassed that. The United States is now the same inequality as China. And if we keep going this way, we're going to end up looking like Brazil. So the notion that like we can bootstrap our way out of poverty and go through the schooling system and so on and so forth, it's sadly becoming a bit of a myth, and there's an elite that's captured a heck of a lot of the gains, and they're playing an insider game. And that's been going on across the world. It's not just the United States. Britain's gone the same way. Even the countries of Europe have become more unequal. And when that happens, you get a kind of politics of plutocracy. Now, if this sounds a bit conspiratorial and a bit lefty, I'd refer anyone who's interested to the website of Citibank, because there are two Citibank research notes from 2006 called Plutonomy 1 and Plutonomy 2 that make exactly this case and advise very seriously well-off people how that their lives are so different from everyone else, they don't really have to worry about debt or democracy. They can just move their assets. So there's definitely something in what you're saying there, John, and those Plutonomy memos from Citibank are a good place to start.
We're getting a little short on time, but we'll take another caller. This is George in Boca Raton. Hi. George, you're up.
My question for the guest is regarding the austerity measures that countries like Greece put into place. I agree with everything he's saying, but my question is regarding, wasn't that austerity forced upon the Greeks because they were in danger of defaulting on their debt? How does a country deal with the default danger without employing austerity in a situation like that? And I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay.
Thank you.
Again, a great question, George. And this is cuts to the heart of the misconception is what's going on here. So I'm really glad you've asked this. Austerity had nothing to do with the budgetary responses of the countries that suddenly found themselves in danger of what's called getting locked out of the markets. And what that means is you've got a bunch of debt out there. You need to basically get to reissue it, to sell it again, to roll it over. And because people were worried about the state of Europe, those yields went up. Now, the response is you have to cut your budget and you get the yields down. But the reason that the yields went up had nothing to do with the size of the budgets. The budgets were very small before 2006 and have gotten worse over time. And in fact, this year, Greece is going up by 13% in terms of its debt, and yet its yields have fallen for the past 12 months. Is that because they've been cutting? Well, it can't be because the debt's gotten bigger, not smaller. So what actually happened? Well, if you were holding euro-denominated assets, government bonds, back in 2010, you suddenly notice something. The Americans have the Fed. They have the ECB. The ECB cannot do the Bernanke trick of pulling out the assets from the banks, adding the liquidity, recapitalizing the banks, delevering the system. They're stuck because the ECB doesn't have a mandate to do it, and the Germans won't let them do it because they're not big enough to absorb the costs. So what you have is a standoff in the North where creditors want paid from debtors and debtors want to default on the North. So if you're holding euro bond, you're going to go, oh my goodness, these things might be trash. They might go to zero. So what happens? The trade becomes more fluid. The yield spikes go up. Now, how do we know that this is really a central banking problem, nothing to do with austerity? Because Mario Draghi, the new president of the ECB, comes out and says, I'll do whatever it takes. Hasn't done anything, just said, I'll do whatever it takes. All the yields went down, irrespective of how much they cut the budget.
Dr. So Mark Blythe, we've just about run out of time. Let me mention the name of your book again, Austerity, the History of a Dangerous Idea. And we'll have links on both our website and also the Topical Currents Facebook page. Thank you very much, Professor.
Oh, pleasure to be with you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
This is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. We'll be back in just a moment.
For many, a charitable bequest is a unique expression of appreciation. The thoughtfulness of many individual families, like the Levinsons and Fines, has led to planned gifts which help WLRN sustain and grow. Through your will or estate plan, you can name Friends of WLRN as the beneficiary of your estate or a portion of it, providing an enduring legacy of public media for years to come. To learn more about making an impact through planned gifts, call 305-350-7977.
You can plan a getaway weekend to the Florida Keys August 23rd through August 25th and take advantage of the third annual Museum and Attractions Weekend brought to you by WLRN and the Monroe County Tourist Development Council. 21 museums and attractions from the Upper Keys to Key West offer special entry to WLRN listeners who present the admissions flyer. A list of participating venues and attractions can be found at WLRN.org. Click on the Florida Keys and Key West Museum weekend banner to print out the weekend pass.
And we return with today's Topical Currents, Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. Cory Doctorow is co-editor of the popular web blog Boing Boing. He's also an offbeat science fiction writer. His plots have more to do with the present than an imagined future. His latest work, Homeland, looks at the blessings and dangers of technology. It follows a young hacker who lives in a paranoid America recovering from a 9/11 scale attack. When the hacker comes into possession of information that could bring down the Department of Homeland Security, he quickly learns at what lengths the government will use to suppress him. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez spoke with Doctorow and asked about life in a, quote, police state.
I think that a police state isn't a binary thing. I don't think you either live in a police state or you don't. I think police state is a thing you do, not a thing you have. And I think that there are times when we do police state in this country. I think the increased use of drones, I think the ubiquitous surveillance online communications and of digital communications have the elements of police state in them, in that they create guilt by association. So that's, you know, the point of things like the no-fly list, where you have a secret algorithm that we don't know how it runs, mining data sources that we don't understand, and doing things like known associates to decide who can have freedom of motion in this country and who will be systematically harassed and who will be grounded. And I think that that has the element of a police state. But I think, you know, is this the same as North Korea? Clearly not. Do we have supermax prisons where people have been locked up because they pled guilty, like 97% of the people who have a federal indictment and who are serving 10, 20, 30 years? We absolutely do, right? So, you know, that's not the same as North Korea, where if you are subversive, they might lock up you and your parents and your kids in their three-generation prison camps to kind of erase your ideological taint from the world. But we do have people who go to jail for decades for things that they believe that they were innocent of, but where they can't afford to fight the federal indictment.
Well, your new novel, Homeland, I assume the title was inspired by the TV series.
No, it predates the TV series, but yeah.
But your new novel, I think, is pretty obviously inspired in part by the WikiLeaks scandal.
Mm-hmm.
How was the image of Julian Assange roaming in your head while you were writing this novel?
Well, I think WikiLeaks is another thing that you do and not something that you are. So Julian, I think, is a distraction when we talk about WikiLeaks, because he's clearly such a lightning rod for controversy. I think we end up, when we talk about Julian, we end up talking about issues about sexual assault and so on. And I think it would be much more useful just to talk about WikiLeaks itself and what its principle is and what it did. And what it did was it received evidence of wrongdoing, at the highest levels of government and corporations, and it made it public in exactly the same way that Woodward and Bernstein did with the Pentagon Papers. And, you know, I certainly feel like that's the hoist on your petard moment of the information age, that the people who fetishize information gathering and fetishize record keeping, that ultimately they're undoing, is that there are records of what's gone wrong as well. That there, you know, I think that the motto of WikiLeaks, which is transparency for the powerful, privacy for everyone else, is a good one.
Hmm. I just have to correct you one thing. I'm a stickler for this. Woodward and Bernstein didn't have anything to do with the Pentagon Papers. It was New York Times by themselves. Then Woodward and Bernstein did Watergate.
I beg your pardon. Yeah, that's an important distinction to make. Yeah, you're right. And let's not take away from the New York Times what's owed to it. Thank you for that.
But let's talk about the novel that preceded this one, Little Brother, mm-hmm. because this is a sequel.
Yeah.
Little Brother came out in 2010. And you know, the didn't
2008.
It? Oh, was it 2008?
You might be thinking of the paperback.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, the title obviously is allusion to Orwell's Big Brother. Mm. Tell us a little bit about Little Brother.
So Little Brother is about kids in San Francisco who, after a terrorist attack on their city, find that their town has been turned into a police state, a real police state, one with checkpoints and everything. And they decide that the only way that they can get the Bill of Rights back and get the DHS out is to kick them out themselves. So they create a kind of guerrilla army. They use a network of hacked, cryptographically secured Xboxes to communicate. Called the Xnet. And they succeed. But they don't succeed on their own. One of the lessons they learn, embrace the slogan, don't trust anyone over 25. There's been deflation since the 60s. But what they realize is that they actually can't succeed without making broad coalitions with traditional media, with new media, with old people and young people, with everybody who has a stake in fundamental freedoms being preserved.
We're speaking with Cory Doctorow, whose latest novel is entitled Homeland. The hero of Little Brother is Marcus Yalow, mm-hmm. and he's also the narrator and hero of Homeland. Tell us something about Marcus. What's he like?
Well, we meet him when he's like a kind of smart alecky 17-year-old high school kid who has figured out how to sneak out of school by zapping the radio frequency ID tags in his library books, by sneaking into the school, the teacher's lounge, and microwaving the library book until the RFID shorts out. And he knows how to beat the gait detectors that they've put in to try and see who's walking where by putting gravel in his shoes and so on. So he's full of all these little bits and pieces of kind of tradecraft that you get if you read the internet. But he's also probably a bit naive, but also principled, as I think is characteristic of a lot of young people. Naive and principled is maybe the adolescent condition. And the first book, Little Brother, is really a coming-of-age story for him, because he has to learn that technology alone won't make him free. He loves his cryptography. He loves his secrecy. What he learns is that there's something called rubber hose cryptanalysis, where you break codes not by attacking them with math, but just by attacking the people who know the passwords. And, you know, his first encounter with rubber hose cryptanalysis changes his reality, changes the way he thinks about how power works in his world, and makes him realize that he has to do more.
And in Homeland, he gets his hands on some information.
Mm-hmm.
And because that's one of the main plot points.
Mm-hmm.
He gets his hands, and the Department of Homeland Security, because in both these novels, Little Brother and Homeland, the enemy is us, as mm-hmm. Pogo would say.
Mm-hmm.
The Department of Homeland Security is the enemy. It's not Al-Qaeda. It's not the terrorists. It's the people who are entrusted to save us.
Sure.
But you portray them in a very sinister light.
Mm-hmm.
I'll play devil's advocate. Couldn't one argue that what they're doing has a certain benefit for society?
Well, if it did, I'd be a lot easier on them. But, I mean, as the security expert Bruce Schneier has said, that the only thing we've done since September 11th that improved the security of the aviation system was putting big, bad locks and steel doors on aircrafts. And everything else would have no nexus with stopping another 9/11, right? You know, we check ID. Well, the 9/11 attackers had ID. We make them take off their shoes. No one's ever successfully blown up an airplane with shoes. I mean, if shoe bombs worked...
They almost did.
No, but they didn't, right? If shoe bombs worked, we wouldn't know why that airplane went down, right? Same with underwear bombs. We buy, you know, the alarmingly named rapey scan machines that show us, you know, that allow the TSA to see your genitals. But, you know, before those machines were procured on German TV, there were people showing that you could defeat them by doing things like hiding a critical quantity of explosive in your mouth. We take away people's liquids, but they've never shown us how a liquid bomb, a binary explosive, would be made. The kind of best guess would be that you'd have to make something called a piranha bath, which requires that you keep the liquid at 0 degrees centigrade, freezing, for about 20 minutes during a critical juncture. So you would somehow have to smuggle a huge quantity of ice into the bathroom and lock the door. I mean, no one's ever explained how this worked. All the chemists who've examined it can't explain it. But the DHS says, well, we know a secret that we can't tell you, and although the terrorists clearly know it, and because of that secret that we can't explain to you, you can't take your water on the airplane. And it seems to me that if we are to sacrifice freedom for security, which, you know, the framers of the Constitution told us was a bad idea, but if we are to do that, well, then by all means, let's actually see the evidence of increased security and not just magical thinking.
Well, this novel and Little Brother is, I guess, categorized as YA. And in the publishing industry, the letters YA refer to young adult or young adult novels. And that's a very popular genre. It's become a very popular genre in recent years.
Yeah, it could stand for yet another as well.
That's true. What makes a YA novel a YA novel?
So I can't speak about all the YA novels, but I can tell you about mine. I view young adult fiction as fiction that can be enjoyed equally by adults and young adults, but has the critical virtue that if you are a young adult librarian or teacher, you can stock it in your classroom or library and probably not get into too much trouble. I think that's probably the main feature of it. You know, generally speaking, a YA novel that you hope to get picked up by the Scholastic Book Club won't have the F word in it. That's kind of a no-go. And you know, there's kind of outward boundaries on things like drug use and sex and so on, and how it's depicted. So I think that's the major definition, you know, the functional definition of the marketing category. But another thing that's frequently a feature of young adult fiction is that it's about young adults. And young adults are really fun to write about because young adults do things for the first time that we've done a million times. And the first time you do something like, say, tell a lie of consequence or do something noble for a friend and sacrifice yourself, you are changed forever. You don't know what you're going to be when you come out of it. And it's incredibly brave and dramatic, which makes the lives of young adults very dramatic.
We need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with novelist Cory Doctorow. I'm Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN.
And this is 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station. We're funded by listeners like you and by All Air of South Dade, offering air conditioning solutions and service in Miami-Dade County. For more information or to schedule an appointment, you can simply dial **cool from your cell phone. That's **2665 and send.
South Florida has a fashion style all its own and a fashion industry that's trying to grow again. I'm Tom Hudson. Join us tonight at 7 for the Sunshine Economy Dress for Success, the fashion industry in South Florida, made possible by Kaufman, Rossin & Company.
Welcome back. I'm Ariel Gonzalez, and this is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is novelist and essayist Cory Doctorow, whose latest work, Homeland, is about a young hacker who learns that the U.S. government has been breaking many laws in the name of keeping us safe. Cory, you primarily in your fiction write science fiction. Now, science fiction has for some time been looked down upon by so-called literary writers. And yet, science fiction has time and again proven itself to be very relevant to current issues.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes even more so than literary fiction.
Mm-hmm.
What is the appeal of science fiction in your view?
So again, I can't. It's a science fiction is a big tent, so I can't talk about all of it. But I'll tell you about the stuff I like, and the stuff I like, I feel, doesn't practice futurism so much as presentism. Science fiction's not very good as a predictive literature, although it's often touted as that. I think if you want to treat science fiction as a predictive literature, you end up doing the equivalent of like firing a shotgun at a barn and then drawing a target around the place where the pellets hit. Because, you know, we've made so many predictions in science fiction and so few of them have come true. But what science fiction tells you a lot about is, whether the author knows it or not, is the present day fears and aspirations for technology and how technology is changing society. And technology has been the primary force for societal change for centuries now. And so probably since Gutenberg. And so science fiction becomes literature for understanding what's going on in the world around you. And I sometimes compare it to what happens if you go to the doctor with a sore throat, and you'll go and you say, there's something in my throat, I don't know what's going on. The doctor, she'll swab the back of your throat, and then she'll touch what she finds there to a petri dish, and she leaves it for a few days. And when she comes back and she looks, it's grown into something that she can identify. And with science fiction, we pluck out one element of technology, a technology that's everywhere, but whose effect is very diffused. And it's really hard to say what's going on. And the science fiction writer builds an artificial world in which that one technology is the totalizing fact of that world. Not because there will be a world where drones are the one totalizing fact, or where surveillance is the one totalizing fact, or where open source is the one totalizing fact, but because by building that artificial world, that petri dish world, and allowing the idea to grow to be the totalizing force there, you can then sort of tease out what those subtle effects are in our everyday world.
Well, you've written quite a bit about copyright. Intellectual property.
Mm-hmm.
Seem to be a man on a mission. You're not opposed to copyright, are you?
No, not at all. No.
But what is your main criticism about the current?
Well, I have two, really, and the one that I think everybody else should care about is the most important one. There's one I have about kind of how copyright organizes things among artists, publishers, and distributors, and that's kind of inside baseball. Unless you're one of those people, it doesn't matter. But the thing that I think copyright gets most wrong is that it assumes that if you are making or handling a copy, you are doing something that should be regulated by the industrial regulation of the entertainment industry, which is copyright. So copyright has historically been written by taking the internal practices of the entertainment industry and its supply chain and turning them into law. And those practices are very complex, and there's lots of exceptions, and they're kind of hard to grasp for a layperson. They're very counterintuitive. But the average person didn't need to grasp them because the average person wasn't inside the entertainment industry. Now, the regulation wants to know who the regulation applies to and who it doesn't apply to. And so the test that it applies is, are you making or handling a copy of a creative work? Because once upon a time, that did imply industrial activity. Every record implied a record factory. Every film implied a film lab. Every book implied a printing press. But these days, that's not true anymore. We make a million copies before breakfast. We've had hyperinflation in copying. And, you know, ideally, if you have that kind of hyperinflation, you change what you use to figure out who's inside the regulation, who isn't. Like, imagine we had a financial regulation that said, well, anytime you're dealing with a $10 million transaction, we treat you like a bank and we want you to talk to the SEC. That kind of makes sense on its face, but if we had hyperinflation and a beer cost $10 million, then buying a friend a drink shouldn't make you into a bank. What we should do is then find a different way of figuring out who financial regulation applies to. Well, we make millions of copies a day. All computers do all day long is make copies. Everything a computer does involves copying, as does the network. And we have refused to change the rule. And so now we have this insane idea that the rule that Universal uses to license Harry Potter from Warner and build the Universal Harry Potter theme park should be the same rules that a 12-year-old in her basement has to follow when she makes a Harry Potter fan website. And you can't have it both ways. Either the rule is complex and useful enough to apply to Universal and Warner's internal dealings, or it's simple and streamlined enough that a 12-year-old gets it right. But if we insist that the 12-year-old parse out the thing that Universal's lawyers have trained for many years in order to conduct what kids have done forever, which is tell stories about the stories they love, then we will criminalize every 12-year-old. And worse than that, in the name of defending it, we are monotonically ratcheting up surveillance and control and censorship on the internet, which is not a glorified cable TV system. It's rather the thing that we use to wire together the whole information age. And we're putting the whole thing at risk in the name of a fool's errand, which is applying copyright to every kind of interaction that we have with one another.
We're speaking with Cory Doctorow, whose latest novel is entitled Homeland. Well, since you discussed that, there is the issue of Aaron Swartz.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote an afterword for Homeland.
Yeah.
And for the people who don't know, Aaron Swartz is a tragic figure.
Yeah.
He's a young man who, would you call him a hacker?
Yeah.
Okay, he was a young hacker who disclosed or hacked into an academic website.
I don't think that's a good characterization.
Okay, correct
yeah.
me.
Maybe I can run it down, because Aaron helped me write the book, and then he wrote an afterword
for
ahead. It. So Aaron was a young technologist. I met him when he was 14 years old and working on internet standards. He'd fly to San Francisco, and my girlfriend at the time was his chaperone, because she worked in the same standards area, and his parents wanted to make sure he was being looked after. And he helped found the website Reddit. He then worked on a project called Recap, which took all the federal law, the judge-made law, the opinions that had been locked up, and he liberated $1.5 million worth of this law that we have to know in order to stay on the right side of the law, and he put it online for free. And then he went after this database JSTOR, where all these technical and scientific articles that had been produced at public expense had been held. And he was a fellow at Harvard, and he went to MIT, where people who used MIT's network were allowed to download JSTOR articles, and he downloaded a lot of them, several million of them. And they claimed, the federal prosecutors claimed, that he'd violated the terms of service. They don't say that he released the documents. He certainly didn't hack into anything. He just went to use a network that was available to the general public and accessed a website that was available to anyone who used that network. And the prosecutors say that if you violate the terms of service, that long, gnarly hairball of agreement that you have to click through every time you do anything on the internet, that you violate the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and that you're a felon. And Aaron was facing a 50-year prison sentence as a result of what amounted to taking too many books out of the library. And he refused to plead guilty, unlike 97% of the people who get a federal indictment. And he fought it. And they fought really dirty. They held documents back that his defense was entitled to in order to make him spend money to try and get those documents out. They all but bankrupted him. And after 2 years of this, and after it became really clear that they were going to not give up until they put this young, principled activist who had really done nothing wrong in prison in order to make an example of him, he killed himself on the second anniversary of his indictment.
And the prosecutor, how did she react to this?
Well, Carmen Ortiz, I don't think, reacted very well. She said, although we threatened Aaron with decades in prison, and although we released a press release saying we were going to put him in prison for decades, we had privately told him that if he pled guilty, we might recommend to the judge that he go to jail for less time. As a result, I think that all those people who are upset with me for hounding this kid into the grave really don't understand the whole story. And there have been WhiteHouse.gov petitions to have her fired. Obviously, those petitions don't mean that they'll take action, but it means that they'll respond, I hope. And I think both she and her boss, Steve Heyman, have political ambitions. And at least I hope that as they move into politics, that the fact that they hounded Aaron and also other young people who had been involved with exploring computers and doing things with them in a principled way, but in ways that may have fallen afoul of a very complicated and unevenly applied statute, they'd hounded them into the grave as well. And I hope that this haunts them through their political career, because one of the things I fear is that these guys might end up making laws.
I'd like to ask one last question about style. You put a lot of information into your novels.
Uh-huh.
Do you ever worry that that's going to impede the narrative flow?
Well, I think that there's readers for whom it impedes the narrative flow, and then there's readers for whom it draws out the climax, right? If you get to a cliffhanger and you say, now, before I tell you what happens to our heroes, let me tell you a bit about what's going on under the surface here. Let me tell you a bit about the technology that's going on here and all the kind of interesting gears and widgets that aren't visible at the surface, but are actually making this whole scenario go. And at first you're like, what? I want to know what happens. And you're like, huh, that's kind of interesting. And then just as it's getting good, you come back to the action. Well, I think that's a nice kind of whipsaw. And it may not work for everybody, but it works for lots of people. I mean, we've sold hundreds of thousands of these books, and they've been published in dozens of languages around the world, and there have been multiple stage adaptations across the country, and the film rights are with the guy who made Natural Born Killers and stuff. So I think it works.
Thank you for coming in. We've been speaking with Cory Doctorow.
Ariel Gonzalez is an English professor at Miami-Dade College. So thanks for tuning in. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. More info as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program looks at the controversy surrounding Miami-Dade's proposed budget. Mayor Carlos Jimenez and the County Commission have come under fire for cutbacks to libraries, firefighting and rescue, and the Pet Trust Initiative. Dan Ricker and others join us. And today's calendar, on this day in 1920, 93 years ago, the birth of comedian Selma Diamond in Montreal. She published essays and cartoons in the New Yorker magazine before moving to radio and TV. She wrote for Groucho Marx, Danny Kaye, and Sid Caesar. And on this day in 1945, 68 years ago, the birth of Lonnie Anderson in St. Paul. Of course, she played the sultry secretary Jennifer on WKRP in Cincinnati. WKRP, more music and Les Nessman. One more. On this day in 1948, 65 years ago, an atomic bomb is dropped on Hiroshima. Miami resident Colonel Paul Tibbetts piloted the B-29 Enola Gay Superbomber. 3 days later, Nagasaki was struck. So we leave with a thought from Lonnie Anderson, who of course had a tumultuous marriage and divorce from Burt Reynolds. Quote, I had my daughter when I was a teenager. I took my daughter to college with me. Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.